Good morning and welcome. The song we just sang is a beautiful song. A song that I hope expresses the desire of everyone here that we might be a part of God's kingdom and service to His Son and to have our desire set wholly in Him. What I want to talk to you about this morning has to do with the tendency of man to have his desire set on other things. The desire for cultural assimilation. When you look around the world, it becomes apparent immediately that people want to be assimilated into some sort of a culture that surrounds them. The way we dress in our clothing indicates the particular type of culture that we want to be a part of. Cowboys dress like cowboys. They don't go to work down at Hereford at the feed yards with tennis shoes on. They go to work with boots on. They dress like cowboys. They have a cowboy hat. Yuppies dress like yuppies. They wear the modern clothing of the day. Nerds dress like nerds. That's just the way they are. Businessmen dress like businessmen. You go downtown around the banks and the insurance companies, and they're all in suits, business suits, and look the part. If you're a part of one of those cultures and you dress differently, as you walk into that culture, people snicker, don't they? If you're a businessman and you walk in dressed a whole lot like a cowboy, then the people in the business there kind of snicker. Well, there's one of those. He's not a part of our culture. Our speech, the things that we say in the way that we go about saying them tells what particular culture we're a part of. We talk alike in a particular culture. The slang that we use, the accents, the metaphors that describe everyday events, sometimes even the cursing and vulgarity go along with particular type of cultures. If you're a part of that culture and you speak differently, then you're just from another planet, aren't you? You've got to speak the language of the culture that you are a part of. The activities of that particular culture, you do things alike. If you are a cowboy down at Hereford, you probably go to ropings. They just recently in Hereford had a great big roping contest. Spicer Grip's annual roping deal that they have down there. And so you're a part of the sports. You're a part of maybe even drinking parties. If the culture you're associated with, that's a part of their culture, is to gather together to drink, then you're a part of that. The entertainment, the music that they listen to. If you refrain from partaking in some of these things, then you become an outcast to that particular culture, and you're no longer assimilated into that. The politics of a particular culture. People have a tendency to think alike in whatever culture they find themselves in. The groups on the far right or the far left, the middle of the road, all of those have their own culture, their own thinking, and they express that to one another. And if you express something different, then you probably have offended somebody. In the matter of religion, cultures worship alike. Atheists and humanitarians worship man as the highest order in the universe. Muslims worship Allah. Hindus Siva and reincarnation. Idolatry flourishes in the worship of Buddha. Denominations practice acts of worship not found in the scriptures. And if you're going to be a part, be assimilated into that culture, you're going to have to practice those acts with them. Try to accept God's word as authority, and you become a bigot, and you're no longer a part of that culture. The pressure to assimilate into one or more of these cultures or classes is enormous, especially in this age of mass communications, where we can get around and see other people and become a part of just about any culture we want to be. You ever thought about the pressure that must have been applied to Noah in his day and age to become assimilated into that culture of people who had nothing to do whatsoever with God, were evil, and every thought of their heart was only evil continually? It must have been great pressure for him to just give up and say, "Oh, I'll just become a part of all that." Lot found himself in Sodom and Gomorrah. The pressure there must have been enormous to become a part of that. Abraham even let it kind of get to him. Remember that he told Abimelech that Sarah was not his wife, it was his sister. Here's how he reasoned about that. In Genesis, the 20th chapter, in verse 10 and 11, Abimelech was chastising Abraham because of this deception. And he said, "What sawest thou that thou hast done this thing? What did you see here that caused you to do this?" And Abraham said, "Because I thought surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will try to slay me for my wife's sake." So what he really did was try to kind of assimilate into that culture. He just thought, "Well, I'll just assimilate a little here and maybe I can save my life." Moses surely struggled. Can you imagine the struggle that Moses must have had to have been raised in the house of Pharaoh in Egypt? The splendor and the power, the treasure of Egypt, and to be raised in that and not assimilate into that culture shows quite a man. But the temptation surely was there. A particular case that I want to look at this morning has to do with an event that happened a long time ago, about 605 B.C. God's wrath is culminating now in the last throes of Judah, before the Babylonians sweep aside the remnants in Jerusalem and take them into captivity. And the story that happens begins in the book of Daniel, and I want you to listen carefully at the narrative of that story. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought the vessels unto the treasure house of his God. And the king spake to Aspenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel, and of the king's seed, and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well-favored and skillful in all wisdom, cunning in knowledge and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. The king appointed them daily provision of the king's meat and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king. The spoils of war are often thought of as treasure. Gold and silver and precious stones. You go conquer this place, especially in this day and age, and you gather up all the treasure in the land. probably along with whatever armaments they had. If they had chariots or spears or whatnot, you'd probably take those as the spoils of war as well. But there's another spoil of war, a treasure that's a lot of times less thought of. After World War II, the U.S. and Russia both took German scientists and brought them back to their countries, technological people. A great amount of credit for our space program goes to a man named Wernher von Braun, one of these German scientists brought back from over there, who had a lot of familiarity at that time with rocketry. A number of other men were a part of that program as well. These men all came to America. They were treated exceptionally well, learned our language, and assimilated into our culture. Well, Nebuchadnezzar saw an opportunity, just like we did with them, to profit from his conquest of Judah. More than just the physical treasure that he'd gather out of there. Look at what is said about those that he brought back with him. He brought back royalty. He brought back the king's seed, princes, those who knew their way around rulers, who had skills of diplomacy and tact. He brought back the physically healthy. He didn't bring back any lame people. He brought back children without blemish and well-favored. He brought back the mentally healthy as well. These were wise people, knowledgeable, understanding in science. These were people who would not embarrass the king. They would have the ability to stand in the king's palace. What it was, Nebuchadnezzar was looking for the Wernher von Brauns of his day. But there's a problem here. To profit from them, the first thing that must happen is they must be assimilated into the Chaldean culture. First of all, it said that they had to teach them the language. And they also had to teach them the learning of the Chaldeans. Now, there's the customs and the cultures, the learning of the Chaldeans. How to dress so that they would fit into Chaldean society. The subtlety of the Chaldeans' court's language. You know, it's not always the what you say, it's the way in which you say it. The activities to engage in and entertainment that was available there in Babylon. The politics of the times. The who's who of the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans, all of these people that surrounded King Nebuchadnezzar. They would have to know who's who there so that they could move in that society. And then, of course, they would have to understand the religion of that people. A ranking of the gods, if you will. From the gods that Nebuchadnezzar served to the gods of all the various tribes and peoples that had been conquered by Nebuchadnezzar. They'd have to understand where all of these gods, and I'm speaking, of course, with a little g, fit into that culture. Well, like the German scientists, Nebuchadnezzar is going to try to butter them up with good positions in the government and a royal treatment in their care and feeding. That seems probably the best way to assimilate these young men into the culture of that day. In Daniel, the first chapter, in the fifth verse, it says, "The king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat, of the wine which he drank." What he's thinking is, I will just immerse them in the pleasures of this culture. Well, among those who were apportioned from the king's table are listed in verse 6. Now, among these were the children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. These were the three Hebrew names, and the king most likely did not want them to retain those names since it would remind them of their former culture. He's going to try to get that former culture out of their minds and their service to Jehovah. And so his eunuch in charge gives them Chaldean names to help in this process of assimilation. Goes on in verse 7 and says, the prince of the eunuchs gave names, for he gave unto Daniel the name of Belshazzar, and to Hananiah of Shadrach, and of Mishael, Meshach, and Azariah, Abednego. Well, there were some other assets that these young men brought when they came to the country that Nebuchadnezzar hadn't reckoned with. They had some other assets besides being royalty, besides being physically healthy and mentally healthy, intelligent, wise, all of these things. They also had a faithfulness and a trust in Jehovah. He thought, surely, you know, time will take care of all this, and as long as they were living in the lap of luxury, it wouldn't be long till they would forget the gods of the land in which they had formerly lived. They also brought with them moral superiority. The character of these men rested in doing as God had taught them. They knew the law of Moses and they kept it. The daily provision from the king's table would no doubt include lots of things that were forbidden by the law of Moses. I'm sure the Chaldeans had no compunction against eating those things which were just totally forbidden by the law of Moses. Most likely the wine from the king's table would also include strong drink as well. So that's why Daniel and the three refused to eat from the king's table. In Daniel, the first chapter, 8th verse, it says, Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. If you remember, Jeremiah had prophesied that this captivity was God's punishment, and those taken should not rebel against the Babylonians. Jeremiah told them, don't rebel against this, because this is God's will. This is the punishment of Judah for the things that they've done. So there's no point in rebellion. You might as well serve this king that comes and takes you. So Daniel and these young men served the king well, and they became very prominent advisors. They were found better than any of the others that were in Babylon. On down in verse 18, it says, now at the end of the days that the king had said he should bring them in, then the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king communed with them, and among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king, and in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in his realm. Well, things were going about as well as they could be. Everything was going fine. But when Nebuchadnezzar had a dream and no one of the Chaldeans could interpret it, the king was ready to put all of his advisors, all these magicians, astrologers, and Chaldeans to death. And all these advisors included Daniel and his three friends. Well, you're familiar with the rest of the story. Daniel prays to God, and God reveals the dream to him, and he reveals it to Nebuchadnezzar. The vision is that one that sets forth the coming kingdoms of men with Rome and the establishment of the kingdom of the Lord. Now, this saved the lives of all the king's advisors and Daniel, and was made ruler over the whole province of Babylon. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were also given lofty positions in the government there as well. So once again, Nebuchadnezzar is busy bringing about assimilation of all his various conquests that he's made. And he decides that all of these religions from all of these lands where he's conquered people, That's too divisive. He doesn't want to have that anymore. So he decides that he's going to bring a union of all these various people. He's going to do it through religion. Surely if he did this, this would be for everybody's benefit. We could stop all this division. And this would benefit everybody by having just one religion in the land. Kind of sounds like what we have today, doesn't it? Let's don't speak against the religions of Buddha or Hindu. After all, they're just worshiping God in their own way. Let's kind of assimilate all that together. Denominations are banding together in unison to say that those Jews who steadfastly deny Jesus as the Christ, the Lord, the Messiah, they're okay in keeping the law of Moses, and we can kind of help support them over there in the land. He's just trying to pull everything together. And so he institutes a national religion. He says, worship this image that I have made. Look at the rituals that are involved with this worship. When you hear the music, as soon as the music comes on, pay attention. Here's your cue when you hear the music. Fall down. Bow before the image. And begin your worship. Praise this God which unites us all. Now comes the test of cultural assimilation. At first it seems to work out fine. In Daniel the 3rd chapter in the 7th verse, it says, therefore at that time when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, the flute, the harp, the sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, all the people, the nations, and the languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Well, look here. Nebuchadnezzar was right. He's going to unite his whole kingdom, and it looks like everything's going fine. But what about the Jews? Were they also assimilated? Nope, they kept their integrity. In no way did they even try to hide their feelings about idol worship. So much so that they were seen not bowing. Some of the people saw that these young men were not bowing when they heard the sound of the music. You'd think that those Chaldeans who had been saved by Daniel's interpretation of the dream would be kind of thankful to him. But actually, what they did is they used this as an occasion to get these fellows in trouble. In Daniel, the 3rd chapter, beginning at verse 8, it says, wherefore at that time certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. They spake and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth, that he should be cast in the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province. Here's the jealousy they're showing of them. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, these men, O king, have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. They have not been assimilated into our culture. Brought now before the king to answer for their failure. Nebuchadnezzar gives them one more chance. In verse 15, he asks, are you now ready? Are you now ready to worship my idol? I've heard old-time preachers in the past use the three B's. And I believe it best describes Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's answer to the king of, are you now ready? Number one, the first B is they did not bend. They didn't look for a way of appeasement. They didn't look for some political correctness statement that would get them out of this trouble. And they didn't lose their courage. They did not bend. Not only that, they did not bow. They steadfastly looked Nebuchadnezzar straight in the eye and refused to kneel before this idol. And then the last B is they did not burn. God, what they said was, our God will save us. But if not, even if He does not, we will have no part of this cultural assimilation. And certainly we know that they did not burn because God saved them. Well, now what we have to do is make some applications for us today. Jesus, in the parable of the soils, spoke of those hearts that were like thorny ground. Mark, the 4th chapter, and beginning of verse 18, He said, "These are they which are sown among thorns, such as hear the word, and the cares of this world, the deceitfulness of riches, and the lusts of other things entering in, choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful." It's so easy for us to become entangled in the cares of this world, wanting to be accepted, and desiring to be with the in crowd. Have you ever noticed that it's really strange that the term in crowd is usually the same crowd that's in trouble most of the time? We look at them frolicking on the beach, drinking, jesting, naked for the most part, if not all together, and we want to be assimilated into that. We see them over in the dark bars and the taverns, dancing, fondling one another and ready for fornication, and think, I must be missing out on the joy of life. Riches become the dominating force in our lives, and we look at the wealthy and we covet his buying power and his able to control things with his wealth. Oh, how we want to be a part of that. Again, to think of unlawful ways in which to become assimilated into that culture. We do a good job at work. Suddenly we're promoted, welcome into the power center of a company. Drinks are poured and passed around. Everyone's laughing and someone says, "Here, have a drink with us." Cultural assimilation begins. How do those thorns grow so abundantly? Everywhere you look, that's what we have, is those thorns growing abundantly. Constant pressure upon us to become assimilated into this culture of sin and depravity in the world. If Nebuchadnezzar could have supplied Daniel and his friends with the poets of today, he would have certainly tried that as well. The poets of today write about the joys of cultural assimilation in every media that you see. The poets of rap music describe women as sex objects, drugs as bringers of joy, and rebellion and murder as righteous acts. That's what rap music does. That's what the poets of rap music are all about. The poets of country and western music, they sing, "Fill my boots up with sand and put a cold one in my hand and lean me up against the jukebox if I die." Is that the kind of poetry that we want to listen to? Rock and roll continues to provide an ever-pounding beat about lasciviousness and drugs. TV and movie poets are perhaps even worse, if that can be so, because they put words and visual images together. They don't just limit themselves to words. They also combine it with visual images. The constant repeating of these horrible lyrics, the viewing of nakedness and fornication, cannot but have its effect on every one of us. It draws us ever closer to this culture of evil. I just know Adolf Hitler had it right. Tell an obvious lie over and over, and it will become the truth. It's obvious that the lie that alcohol is good for us has worked. You tell that lie over and over, and people begin to listen to it, and drinking goes wild. It's an endless parade of drinking songs extolling the virtues of drunkenness that wear us down. The same is true of all sin. Show the practice of it and ring out its praises, and the obvious lie becomes truth in one's mind. And yet, what I worry the most about as parents, we give in and yield to the whining of our children who say, all my friends will abandon me if I don't go. Well, who cares? Let them abandon them. Some will say, well, things were different then. Things were not different then. Can you imagine the environment that Daniel and his friends had to live in there in Babylon? I don't believe Daniel and the others could have been in a more sinful and godless place than Babylon. They survived because they listened to the righteous poets of their day, the poets that were inspired of God. And that's the poets that we need to start listening to instead of the common poets of the day. The Psalms and the Proverbs, that's what Daniel and his friends had as poetry that they listened to, the Psalms and Proverbs. They survived because they listened to Moses and not Hugh Hefner. Just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we need to make up our mind that this culture of sin that surrounds us will not assimilate us. Because if we don't make up our mind that it won't, it will. We need the two assets that they brought with them to Babylon. Faithfulness and a trust in God and a moral superiority, the result of heeding God's instructions. Let's don't bend to accommodate the world, and let's don't bow to the idol of hedonism and lust that's been set before us. And then God will deliver us from Satan and his realm, and we will not burn, just like they would. Well, Jesus said in Matthew, the 11th chapter, beginning at verse 28, come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and ye shall find rest unto your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Are you laden with cares, the burden of sin? Do you labor under the oppressive realm of Satan in a world of rottenness and decay? There's something you can do about it. But you first of all have to cast off the yoke of Satan and submit to the yoke of Jesus. Learn of him, and he will give you rest. You can begin today if you will come believing that he is the Lord, the Son of God, with healing in his wings. Do what he asks of you. In Mark 16:16, Jesus asked of us to believe and to be baptized, and having done that, we'll be saved. But he that believeth not shall be damned. Live for him and inherit eternal blessings. If you're a child of God and the culture has influenced and assimilated you, it's still not too late. You can cast that off. You can begin once again to learn of him and to do his will. If we can help you in any of this, We'll urge you to come as we stand together and sing the song of invitation.